So I got up this morning and there's snow outside.
Wow.
What the ever-loving fuck?
With the fact that it's the 28th of November and you live in the Northern Hemisphere?
Yeah, but it was like 50 last week. I don't know. No, bad.
Yeah.
Bad, bad, bad. And I have things to do today that involve the outdoors and I'm not happy.
Yep, that's the, you don't have your winter blood on yet.
I do not.
I was having that issue on Saturday night. My wife and I had to go run some errands and the air pressure was low in the tires. So I got out to pump the tires up and the wind was, it wasn't blowing that much, but I had a coat on, right? A proper Wisconsin coat. And I got in the car. I'm like, oh my God, the wind is hurting my face. It's got to be like 15 degrees outside. It was 34. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my God. I don't, and I'm surprised every year that it's like, in November when it starts to, you know, get chilly again, it's such a shock. But come like mid-January, I'll be wandering around in a sweatshirt and no coat.
Oh, right, just right. Like, and
it's 20
March,
degrees. I don't need a jacket.
Well, and in March when it hits 34, you'll be wearing shorts going, this is awesome. Spring is here.
Oh, certainly all the Gen Zers on campus will be running around in tube tops and short shorts.
Oh yeah.
But anywho.
Yeah, I don't
way to kick off the podcast, old man, talking about the weather.
It's well, yeah, I know. Sorry.
Can't take it. I don't like it. Finish your Geritol so we can get on with it.
Aww. I had my coffee like 3 hours ago. I've been awake for way too long. Mm-hmm. All right. So we read the new brewer. So this is an episode of We read it so you don't have to. We read it so you don't have to.
We read it so you don't have to.
Yes. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in there on the hot market, and we talked about this a few weeks ago when the preliminary numbers were out, and guess what? It's the same.
Yeah, we're not going to bore you with it, is what you're telling me?
Nope. It's all the same. If you want to hear us talk for 45 minutes about how sad we are about Cascade rolling down the hill while all this other stuff goes up, and Citra's the king for reasons that we cannot understand, then you've got that episode. It's out there. It's available.
What I found interesting just at a very high level here about this is that Hopsteiner's private report that came out is basically the same thing as the official hop, global hop report. You know, like the same data. So it's like, what's that say for who controls the majority of the global hop production?
Oh, sure. Right. Sure. Look, it's no different than when, you know, when McDonald's makes a beef purchase and the global price changes.
Well, that's why every time, funny story, every time the McRib comes out is usually 6 to 8 weeks after the low point in the pork market.
Interesting.
How about that?
The McRib being a low point in the pork life cycle.
Or we think it's pork. I mean, let's just be honest. Mm-hmm. We don't know. But anyway, this is about hops, not about pork.
Shouldn't there be some type of law where, you know, things that reference real food should be in quotes? Like, shouldn't McRib have quotes around it?
Well, that's why they have to call them McNuggets. They can't call them chicken nuggets because, you know, really have chicken in it? Because the chicken slurry nuggets just doesn't have the same appeal.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, there's another article in this month's issue that we thought was pretty interesting that we wanted to talk about. And so you might want to take the kids away from this one so they're not hearing what's going on. Because this is a disturbing situation that's happening now. And it's this new phenomenon in hops where there are certain varieties, and we've seen this with James and with Citra, that are just, they really just rub people the wrong way, and they make them very upset. And this concept of hop terror, where it chases them away from certain beer styles.
Hop terror.
So the whole article on hop terror.
Nice. Let's talk about hop terror.
Let's talk about hop terror and this fear of certain varieties that some of us have.
Exactly.
That's the article you told me to read, right? About
it
hop terror?
Yeah, wasn't that in Psychology Today? That was the one. So it's not New Brewer, right? It's
no.
Okay. All right. Good. Yes. Terroir. Hop terroir. Oh. One of my favorite freaking subjects. And you should just take the children away, get them out of earshot, because there's going to be a lot of expletives in this episode.
Terroir. I missed the I.
You missed terroir. The I. Yeah.
Okay. All right. My bad. My bad.
Okay. Are you still okay to talk about this, or do you? Need...
I guess I'll figure it out. Okay. I'll figure it out. Yeah. I think I read the wrong thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So terroir, the idea of the wine, the really something that started in the wine industry. So I assume first became a thing in the wine industry, where you're looking for these micro regional differences in flavors.
Can we set some foundation rules here first?
Oh, Lord.
Before we get into this.
Sure.
In the consumer's mind, terroir is associated, like you said, with the wine industry, or really the impact of the land and the local micro environment on the essence of a product. So in this grapes, or, well, people want to attribute this to hops. But what the industry looks at when we say terroir is that impact needs to be reproducible year over year, such that all the grapes that come from that given region of that variety have this kind of special characteristic. So if you grow those Pinot grapes up on that ridge over there, and you've done it for, you know, generations, they have this kind of essence and character. You go 80 or 100 kilometers to the south into a valley, somebody growing that same variety of Pinot grape has a slightly different character to it, right? Year over year, there's small fluctuations year over year, but that difference between those two sites on that same variety is there, and it's perceivable by consumers and by the laboratory. Okay? That's the ground rules. When we're talking about terroir, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about the idea, the sexy idea that your hops that are grown in, I don't know, New York State are characteristically different in that sense than hops that are grown in Yakima Valley. Okay?
All right. Well, makes sense.
Let's set that ground rules. Okay. Go.
Oh, well, I mean, my gut reaction to this whole concept is, I don't know how you separate the idea of local flavor, if you will, from individual farming practices that differ from person to person to person and farm to farm to farm. I have a hard time believing that the land trumps the grower.
Right. Awesome. And that's called horticulture.
Really?
It is. Well, I mean, that's what it is, right? Horticulture is the science, the science of the human interference with the natural growing state of a plant for whether it's floral flower production, you know, for pretties or for actual eating stuff, right?
That's for pretties.
So that's horticulture, right? So it's the impact of the human on the production system. Where, like, something like straight up agronomy, like row cropping, there's very little human interference in its production cycle. You plant the seed, it grows, you harvest it. You don't really go out there and try and change its environment in order to make it do one thing or another, right?
Right, right.
Here's the kicker. This whole thing about terroir, and I understand Stan Hieronymus wrote this article, and I like Stan. I've known Stan for a long time. He's a fixture in the beer industry as a writer. He's an exceptional writer, and we're looking for a story here. And the story that is being told over 90% of this article is opinion, until we get to the last 10% of this article where we're talking to scientists. And he references several journal articles in this, which is great, fantastic. I love that. Show me references. Being James, I go and I dig up the scientific articles because I want
to
see.
You're not supposed to do that.
I want to see what the data say, right? There's also interviews in there with, you know, reputable people in the industry, scientists like Tom Shellhammer and whatnot. And if you really read what they're saying in response to this terroir thing, they are completely noncommittal.
They are, and I would argue that even Stan is non-committal.
I agree. Absolutely agree. Right? So I'm not bashing Stan about this at all, but he's presenting the observation and the opinion, mm-hmm. right, of
sure.
people out there. But what I don't feel in this article is that it's heavily weighed to what people want to believe versus what actually is. So there was an opportunity there to provide more of a level set, which is because the data say this doesn't exist. Right?
Right.
As the foundational rule that I set forth in the beginning, it doesn't exist. If, let me just hold on a second here, pull up one of these articles that summed it up the best. And if anybody wants these articles, we're happy to share.
Oh, sure. We will put links to the articles in the resources section on hopnology.com. Mm-hmm.
Go down to the end. Always go to the end. To the summary section.
Sure. Because the first 18 pages are a bunch of jibber-jabber.
Yeah, data, graphs, you know. When you look at these data, what you will find, Greg, to your point, you're going to see differences. You're going to see variations in these crops. Let's say from comet grown in Germany versus comet grown in the Pacific Northwest. You're going to see differences. You're going to say, wow, yeah, look at that. The xanthohumol's higher over here. The polyphenols are higher over here. James, you're just proving the point. Terroir exists. No. What we're showing is that for that production season and for that growing condition, like how they're being handled and dried, how they are, what time of the year they're harvested, because you start throwing in all these maturity indicators and whatnot, you start to see that those differences get consumed in the variability and the noise of the data.
Yep.
So what we're seeing here is any differences within that season. So let's say 2020 between Hallertauer, Germany and Yakima, Washington, on the same variety of the same maturity, same age, same plant age, those differences only occur within that year. Because the next year, when you look at it, 2021 crop, and you look back at 2019 crop, the differences might be there. You may say, okay, yeah, Germany's still a little bit higher, but the variability is so wide such that it is not significant, mm-hmm. right? You're like, yeah, it's there, but is it real? And everybody's heard us talk about how to interpret that as part of the scientific method. Lab results are one thing, but when we talk about terroir, we're talking about, I want to be able to taste this, and this is something I can hang my hat on, right? So that means it's all got to go back to the sensory panel to review these and be able to pick out, yep, absolutely without a doubt, those comet from Hallertauer are different than these in the Pacific Northwest year over year, right?
Yep.
That's something you can put a flag in the ground and say, these are Hallertauer comet, right? Right.
And to your point with the year over year, that consistency is key.
Or these are Michigan Chinook, or these are whatever it happens to be. In every instance in these scientific articles, I can sum this up with one sentence, what the findings were. And I'm reading verbatim. No great differences were found in the tastings made by various panels.
Boom. Yeah, that's the end of terroir.
Terroir and hops doesn't exist. Get over it. Mm-hmm. It's just, it doesn't. Now, if you want to hang your hat on being local, fine, do that. We can show, and we've proven this with the data that we did at our last research project at Gorse Valley, where we looked at drying temperature and the aroma profiles. So I can take Cascade growing on the same farm, side by side, dry one with conventional heat at 130 degrees Fahrenheit, and dry one with no heat and dehumidification, and have radically different aroma profiles. So there, the horticulture is impacting that essence. The horticulture post-harvest. It has nothing to do with the land and the climate and this whole romanticized view we have of terroir on the perception. Mm-hmm. It was an engineering feat. I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah, and you know, it was interesting. One of the people interviewed in the articles, and it was Sam Caglione from Dogfish Head was one of the first people who was quoted here who does not believe at all in terroir. And I think it was him who said something to the effect of, you know, folks are using this to blind consumers with geography.
Correct. Absolutely. And it was, I believe, always a marketing ploy for non-traditional growers in non-traditional areas to provide them some sort of competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't blame them. But
No. Here's the quote he has here. The wine world has wrapped this one word with mighty voodoo powers and created a cult of exclusivity around it.
Correct. However, now, we can prove this in grapes.
Mm-hmm.
It is a thing. Mm-hmm. We can prove this in other woody perennial crops like apples, but to a much lesser extent. Much, much lesser extent.
I think about oranges and, you know, Florida oranges. Oh, my God, I have to have Florida oranges.
Nope.
Doesn't mean a thing.
Doesn't mean a thing. Mm-hmm. Vidalia onions. Right. So this idea of, oh, Vidalia onions, they're the best. Right. And all Vidalia onions are sweet, and they're, you know, you can tell they're Vidalia because they're flattened, right? And they're not like globe shaped, and they're less pungent. You gotta have a Vidalia onion. Vidalia is a county, and it's been branded having that type of onion, which is a varietal characteristic, not a result of where it's grown. How many people talk about the terroir of their tomatoes? You ever hear that?
No.
Not a thing. How about your carrots? Because nope. That terroir is really a big deal, right? Here's the thing, is that really you're only going to be able to track terroir in perennial crops. Now, hops are herbaceous perennials. They're not woody perennials, so they die back to the ground every year. But all of the characteristics that go into creating the essence of that hop cone happens in the herbaceous part. So unless it's going to be exposed year, you know, season over season to the wind and the cold and, you know, having the seasonality to it, you're just not going to see it. It's not going to be there. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Compared to something like a grape or an apple and to some extent blueberries and some other cane crops will have that true to assumption terroir, exhibit that true to assumption terroir. You're just not going to see it. It's not there. Stop trying to make it something that it isn't.
Mm-hmm. I think it's much more important from a sustainability and a local and a footprint issue than having anything to do with regional flavors.
Absolutely. 100% agree with you. That is the play. If you want to educate your consumer and make where you are that much bigger of a deal, you can't go with terroir because, frankly, you can't prove it. So then it's a bunch of bullshit. So it makes you look stupid, right? Do you really know what you're talking about? No, you don't, because it doesn't exist. Because you can look in the research, and the research says it doesn't happen. Yes, it does, because I want to believe it does. No, it doesn't. Take that opportunity to invest in your community and tell that story, to your point, Greg, about, well, just what our last podcast was about. Talk about its locality and its impact on the environment and its embodied energy. This, feel better about using these hops because they have 50 to 70% less energy in them to get them to you. What does that mean for you? Right. Talk about, let's say you're using no heat drying. Talk about the benefits there that are measurable, both in the pint by a consumer and in the laboratory. Talk about that kind of stuff. But the fact that, you know, my Cascade growing in, I don't know, XYZ County in New Jersey are better because they're growing here is total horseshit.
And as you read through this article, more and more of the folks he's quoting say we don't talk about it. One person from the New York Hop Guild says we don't use the word terroir. Jason here from Strong Rope Brewery in Brooklyn says we only use hops grown, you know, here in New York. I don't know how far you get into it with terroir, he said. We try to express their unique. Local to me is more important than terroir, whether it's verbiage on the menu or bartenders talking to customers. We're trying to continue the conversation and get to the point where beers are regional again.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. It's exactly the way it should go.
Yeah.
That's the play.
It is. It's about local. And we've talked about local before. I think one of our first episodes ever was about, does local matter? Mm-hmm. And we discussed then the fact that when we had Gorse Valley Hops, we had a hard time selling at a premium on the basis of local. So there is, of course, a cost to local mm-hmm. versus Pacific Northwest for a whole lot of reasons, which you would know if you'd been listening for the last 3 years.
Right.
But yeah, that's the local is about, again, to your point, the carbon footprint, your desire to support local in a lot of other things. It doesn't change the flavor.
Invest in your community. That's what mm-hmm. that's the narrative. I think that would be ultimately more valuable.
Yep.
Because that plays on people's emotions.
It does. It absolutely does.
And you know, all you got to do is put some Sarah McLachlan music behind that, and people will just start handing you money.
You know, oh, lovely.
For just $1 a day, you can support a New York State hop grower. He's got in the arms of the angels behind you.
Yep.
Exactly. Put Chad's face up there. That'd be great.
Now I will add to that that quote from him that I was using voice to text to put that into my notes earlier, and for some reason my autocorrect likes changing terroir to Chihuahua.
I think there's probably some room with that. I think there's probably a lot of Chihuahua essence in Citra production, but
of course there is.
Okay, so one caveat to this, and this is one thing people are calling out right now, because they're those of us that are in it are screaming at their radio or their whatever they're listening to us on right now.
Their radio.
Phone. Yeah, radio.
Who is a radio anymore?
Radio Alpha Niner 473.
Old man.
But what about Chinook? Because James, you had Skyrocket and you said it was different than regular Chinook, right? And that's got to be mm-hmm. terroir, right? Because yours was much less piney and much more tropical fruity, and Michigan is seeing something very similar.
That was a scientific growing practice.
So that's horticulture, right? And so the impact of horticulture on production practices, isn't that part of terroir? Can't that be part of terroir? Because if you look at the definition in the dictionary, that's what it says. Here's my thing with that. What we found was that, and this was not a study. This was some testing we had done, because we weren't completely convinced at the time that these were Chinook. But their growing habit, the cone shape and size, and all those sorts of things were the same as Chinook. The farms that we got these rhizomes from were growing Chinook in Utah. And, you know, we got some of those actual cones, and yep, they had the characteristic pininess, right?
Mm-hmm.
There were subtle DNA changes that happened because of, well, I don't know why, we call it epigenomics. So epigenetic changes, where the environment can impart a change to that hop or to that plant such that it starts expressing different things. That is a genetic shift that is not terroir. So now what you've got is a subvariety. And that subvariety, you should be able to pick up and take other places and have it, those genetic traits be stable and produce similar results. And so one of the regrets that I have that we couldn't get done before we sold the farm and whatnot is to take some of those, quote, skyrocket plants and send them out to somebody like Crosby out west and say, plant these and see what happens. Because then that would have said, hey, guess what? These are, we're getting this sort of tropical fruity thing that you were getting. Okay, that proves, quote unquote, that these epigenetic changes that we could measure in the microsatellite DNA, which I don't want to get into, in this variety, there was an impact of the environment and on causing a, it's not a mutation. I don't want to go that far, right. But it's a change in some of this other genetics that can create some of these secondary and tertiary compounds that create these flavor profiles. That is not terroir. That is a genetic change. Because when we, if I go back to my Pinot example, and we measure the genome of those Pinot grapes grown in two different, you know, microclimates, 100 or 200 kilometers apart, there is no genetic shift. So really, it's the response of that plant to its environment that's creating those things. It's whatever the day-nighttime fluctuations in that valley are that create that grape year over year to produce higher tannins than it does 200 kilometers to the north. That's terroir. That's not a genetic change. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to lay that out there.
Okay. Yeah, because you're right. That's a, I'm not going to say it's a subtle difference, but it's understandable to lean into terroir as the explanation for Skyrocket, certainly.
Correct. And I don't believe that's the case, because if it was, I would be all over it. I'd be like, absolutely, you guys would be, I would have all sorts of studies going on, but the fact that the other data that are present, the very specific data sets that we have deliberate to address this exact topic, looking at regions that are vastly different but still hop growing regions, do not produce any significant differences in either the lab data or the sensory analysis, that's enough for me.
I'm actually, honestly, I'm surprised that there is no difference in the sensory analysis, and not because I believe in terroir, but because between growing practices and just different rainfall, mm-hmm. and history of that particular farm and what's been used in the soil over all those years, there's so much variability farm to farm to farm. I just have a hard time believing that the hop can be so consistent that it's the same halfway across the world.
It's not.
Which I guess even further reinforces that a Chinook's a Chinook's a Chinook.
Well, they're not that consistent. The lab data shows you that. It's like, well, this xanthohumol is higher from this farm, but it's lower over here. This polyphenols are generally higher here, but lower over here. So you'll see that variability. But here's the deal. How much of that makes it into the beer? Because if you look at grapes, which is what we want to think about in terroir, what percentage of wine do grapes make up?
A fair amount of it, yeah.
Yeah. Besides water, all of it.
It's all grape.
How much of beer does hops make up?
A little bit.
Even in the most stupid smash mouth, you know, IPA you could hit, 5% tops. Mm-hmm. Tops. It's too small. You're never going to pick up those differences. They don't exist. Right. So from an essence standpoint and a selling standpoint for growers in various regions saying our hops are X, Y, and Z and you got to use these because they're so much more different. No, they're not. You're never going to see it, even if there were any. It's not there.
Whereas, you know, getting back to the other point from last week, the impact in that beer of those hops on local economy and growing practices and carbon footprint and whatnot, that is relevant.
That
does mean something.
Those are hard numbers, and you can take that to the bank. I didn't use too many swear words.
You didn't. Do we want to talk about barley at all?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, let's talk about barley. There's one other thing in the article. Not the article, in the issue, mm-hmm. Sorry, was not in the same article. That would not have made any sense.
No.
There were tons of hop stuff. Go read it.
Well, it's the raw ingredients issue, right?
It's the raw ingredients issue, right? I still hate the title.
Yeah.
I still hate the title.
Yeah.
There was some information on barley production, and I'll be honest, I don't know a lot about barley production, but I had no idea, first of all, that since the 90s, Canada eclipses U.S. production by a ridiculous degree. 3-1?
Mm-hmm.
I was not aware of that. But both Canada and the U.S., and particularly the U.S. is just plummeting in barley production, but Canada's is down a fair amount, but still, by and large, controls barley production.
Well, I just...
In the North American landscape.
And I, as I told you, I'm like, we went from the U.S. in the early 90s about 900 million acres, right? Is that what it is? 900 million? Yeah.
It was, I'm looking at
or nine million acres. Sorry. 9 million acres. I got to put my glasses on, James. To, in 2021, 3 million. Wow.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Holy hell. Where's all of our malt coming from then? Our barley? Does it come from Canada?
Well, I mean, ours might be. I'm looking now at the global. Well, what's interesting is that Europe, what they're calling here in this article, the European Union, which includes the UK, you know, far and away, they do six, seven, eight times the barley that Canada does.
Wow.
And they are, you know, three times Russia, which is number two.
Okay.
So that's where it's coming from.
Yeah.
That's why it's all soggy.
Commie beer.
It's there all the time.
Commie beer. commie beer.
Oh, my. And there go those two listeners. There, thank sorry, you very guys. Much.
Sorry. I tease because I Come love. On. I tease because uh-huh. I love.
Man, oh, man. Well, interestingly enough, though, just looking at the top producers, I mean, Europe and the UK, then Russia, then Australia.
Hmm.
And then the Ukraine. Yeah. And then Canada and the US.
Wow. Yep. There you go. I mean, I don't know much about the barley production side of things because it's not horticulture. I'm not an agronomist. So
right.
It's what, Dakota, North Dakota? What are the?
Yes. It's North Dakota, Montana, and Idaho.
And I know Those that three. There was a 10 years ago, there was a huge interest in local barley.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Wisconsin's still trying to grow it, but we just don't have the environment. It's far too wet here in the early spring when in the cool season when barley grows compared to the high plains and into southern Canada where it's cool and dry during those times of year.
That's, you say 10 years ago. I mean, it's been in free fall for 30 years.
No,
in the
US. I'm talking 10 years. And for the last 10 years, the interest in local barley production, like okay. doing it, like in Wisconsin, saying, yeah, we're going to grow local barley too. And they tried it and it's awful because it's usually too like diseased or doesn't have the right malting characteristics or blah, blah, blah.
So I'm going to correct myself here. And I mentioned that the, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth, you know, Canada was the fifth ranked country in barley production. The U.S. was sixth. I was wrong. U.K. is the sixth. Is it 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12? U.S. is the 13th.
Yeah.
We are behind Ethiopia, Kazakhstan, Morocco in barley production. It's just not a thing here.
Well, that's total barley production, but that's... Does it say anything about how much of this is malting barley?
No.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's like, okay, how much of this actually goes to malting? This is just bark, because, I mean, there's barley used in all sorts of stuff. And you look at some of these other countries that you mentioned, barley's a staple crop. It's a cereal crop. They're not using it for malting. So, or they're using it for animal feed. So I'm like, how much of this is actually going to malting, to beer?
Oh, and see, I just assumed that anything is just about beer.
Oh, no.
What else could you possibly use barley for?
Soup. Breads.
Soup.
I mean, good Lord, man.
Wait, you're forgetting my general lifestyle, and that's that. I'm sorry. Is it, you know, I'm in food truck world. Does barley exist in French fries or chicken wings?
I don't know.
Because if it doesn't, it's not really of interest to this conversation.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I understand. Well, for the rest of us out there.
If for anyone who's been to a brewery that has an oatmeal truck, don't go to that brewery anymore.
Well, that would be oats. We're not talking about oatmeal. You'd have to have barley mush truck, which is what you're getting out. Ooh, wait a minute, Greg.
Uh-oh.
Business idea, all those spent grains.
All the spent grains.
Mm, yep. Right there you go. Barley gruel for everyone. It works. It works. It works on so many levels.
Could,
I'm a genius.
Could you imagine the fully sustainable food truck outside your brewery that's
totally.
Serving barley
just
grains?
It's got a big pulsating hose that's squishing spent grains into bowls and glop.
At least tell me there's a toppings bar where you can throw some raisins and some brown sugar in there.
And whipped cream and cherries, all kinds of stuff, you bet.
Oh, My, oh, my.
I think we'd all be very regular. And with all those spent hops in it, our digestive tracts would be squeaky clean.
This might be what finally gets us kicked off iTunes.
You think so?
I might be the one to request they kick us off. I don't know. It's...
Well, so I'm looking at this. I'm looking through this article, looking at these data, and I'm trying to see any mention of malting barley in this. And I'm not. I don't even see the word malting in here.
No, I don't either. And you'd think they would have reduced the metrics to that piece of it.
Because there's this one line in here where it talks about. It's like they say it so nonchalantly, like, oh, yeah, Montana was down 10,000 acres in production. I'm like, can you imagine? It was like the hop industry was down 10,000 acres this year. I'm like, oh, shit.
There'd be riots. There'd be riots.
Did the entire West Coast slide off the face of the earth? What happened?
Wow.
Oh, wow. My God.
I know you said that you are not an agronomist, but there's a table here, table 4, which are the plumpness values of spring barley kernels in Europe. Any insight on what that actually refers to?
It's about grain filling. So, you know, the plumpness of the kernel is going to relate to how much starch it has. And so they look at that as a measure also of yield because, you know, the bigger, the plumper the kernel, the more bushels per acre you're going to get.
I just wanted to hear you say that.
Plumpness. Barley gruel for everyone.